As we continue this evening, I want to pick up kind of where we left off last time as we were talking about parables and the challenges to listen to those particular parables. In our study guide, we were talking about these particular parables, and the one that we had initially talked about was the parable of the sower, looking at some of those questions at the end of the chapter, dealing with the parables under well-taught disciples. Questions of reflection, for reflection and discussion, as we were talking about what each of these different soils mean and how all of that works out. The next question that we have in all of this has to do with the parable of the wheat and the weeds and the parable of the net. Those parables came about, Jesus talked about in the parable of wheat and the weeds. The question was asked, how do we weed things out? How do we weed out? And that's W-E-E-D. That's not a mispronunciation of R-E-A-D. Well, you know, Elmer Fudd and all those kinds of things. But in the parable of the weeds, we're looking at chapter 13 in Matthew, starting in verse 36. Get over there. After the parable of the sower. And we do find that Jesus gives these parables in various ways linked together. We had the parable of the sower and dealing with the seeds, and now we go to the weeds and the good wheat over here, starting in chapter 13, verse 36. Then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples approached him, saying, "Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field," because he had just told this parable about the weeds and the guy saying, "Master, didn't you sow good seeds?" That parable is in verses 24 and following. You sow good seeds and you got weeds coming up, and shouldn't we go out there and just start separating them out? And so Jesus begins to explain this parable. He said, "The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one. And the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all evildoers, and they will throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Let anyone with ears listen." So I guess they're sunflowers. So when we start looking at this, this particular thing about the weeds and the good seed that Jesus is teaching, you know, we find in our own world there's good seed and there are weeds, right? One of the things that I haven't figured out yet is, and I've said it over and over again, why when we have a drought and the grass won't grow or the wheat won't grow, the weeds will. Okay? And what we try to do is cultivate the weeds out of the gardens, right? But once they reach a certain point, is there a point that comes about, and Jesus is trying to make a point here, I think, and I'd like to ask what you think his point is. Is there a point that comes about where it is not advantageous to begin weeding the garden? If we let it get going too far, is there a point where it's not advantageous? And if so, why? Well, you could plow it all up and start again. But then you've got the good being destroyed with the bad, which then raises the whole Sodom and Gomorrah question, among other things, you know, that Abraham raised. Would you kill all the good along with the evil? What if I find so many righteous? But does it say something about what else might it say? Robert says he's going to go ahead and just tear it all up, start again. But when we're talking about people, it's different. It could also be, depending on when the time is and the crop is getting ready to come in, that you don't want to do it. You don't want to tear the whole thing up. But what is Jesus saying to us about ourselves and about the nature of the world as well as the nature of Christians? I started to bring in here a non-canonical writing I've got in my office called the Didache. Right. Right. But he did say though that people, it's different with people, but it is, yes. I still remember a math teacher that I had, Thad Thomas. Drove a green Alfa Romeo. Always liked that car, a little green Alfa Romeo. But he was, if you didn't confess, that was Thad Thomas. Everybody, girls and guys, this is in junior high school, made you want to turn somebody in, but you didn't want to be a snitch. And we would duck walk the hall. That was our punishment. The whole class duck walked the hall. From one end to the other until somebody either confessed or he just got tired of watching us duck walk. I don't ever remember. No. That is the unfair thing. Yeah. Okay. Well, what does the Didache says that there are two ways to a man, a way of life and a way of death, and that we have both opportunities within us in our spirits. We can either choose the way of life or we can choose the way of death, that is, to follow the evil influences as opposed to the good influences. Sometimes we end up doing some of both. Why is it so evil? Why is it so hard sometimes to separate the good and the bad influences within our own selves? We're human, but what happens? Okay, let's go back to the parable. You've got weeds and you've got good plants, and they're both growing along, and then all of a sudden you decide you're just going to go out there and start raking all the weeds out from in between the good plants. And what's liable to happen? You get the good plants. Why? That's right, because the roots have intertwined. The roots have intertwined. And sometimes it's difficult to separate out those who are the bad influence from the good, and we have to wait until the particular point in time, he's saying, that good and evil natures are intertwined just like the roots of wheat and weeds that intertwine. Well, you would hope that the good would influence the bad, but what ends up happening a lot of times, though, in the garden situation, the weeds take over, which is all the more reason to, and Jesus will, in Matthew, very often tells parables and does other things and talks about the little ones, and while he's talking about disciples on some of those occasions, those new disciples who are like the little ones, just learning, he's also talking about teaching the little ones. And that was so important within Judaism and then within early Christianity to make sure that the little ones were taught, so that if they're taught from a tender age and the evil influences are at least somewhat removed, what would happen? The better chance that they would grow as a good crop. Okay? And we find that within Judaism as well, that we're to that they were to instill those strong roots. They were to talk about it at home and in the marketplace, not just in the synagogues, so that the children would learn and their children's children would learn. That doesn't mean that the evil inclination is not going to be there. I mean, any of us that have totally gotten rid of sometimes making the wrong choice, giving in to the temptation of what we think might be easier, but it may not be the best choice. You know, as human beings, we have that difficulty as well. But what we do have here is Jesus is promising here, as he does in the parable of the net, that God, in the end, will sort out. Can you think of another parable that might be similar to that, where God, in the end, is sorting out that which is desirable from the undesirable? The sheep and the goats, the last judgment. The sheep were more desirable than the goats, and he would weed them out. But that's also about people, right? This is about people who follow the good influences and people who follow the bad influences. Well, the sheep and the goats are the same way. Those who follow the good and those who follow the bad, they're weeded out. But how did Jesus determine what was good and what was bad and what was acceptable and what was not in the parable of sheep and the goats? In Matthew 25. Places the sheep on his right hand and the goats on the left hand. And he says, come to those on his right. Come, enter the kingdom that was prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. Thirsty and you gave me drink. The determination was not made based on what creed you said or anything like that or those to whom you were born. The determination was made on how you grew in that, not just internal, but that spiritual walk. Well, the goats do eat the weeds. The goats, tie some goats out here, and we'll get rid of this kudzu in a hurry. The scapegoat. The goat, in part because of some influences, even later with Pan. But other influences, the goat was associated with more with that which was less desirable, more in the line of the demonic. If you look at a pentagram, oftentimes you'll have the face of a goat very easily drawn in that kind of thing. But the sheep provided, of course, they ate the lambs and they ate the goats too. Yes. But the sheep providing the wool was more desirable and spun much better than the goat hair. Goat hair was much more coarse, etc. Typically, and when he says that he'll separate them like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats, it'll be that easy that we can't hide. Whether if we've got an evil inclination, it won't be hidden from God. If we've got a good inclination, it won't be hidden from God. Just as easily as a Palestinian shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. Typically, in Palestine, the sheep were white or an off-white. It's rare that you ended up with a black sheep, and that was a bad omen. Goats were black or a charcoal gray. It's rare that you found a white goat in Palestine. And so, that easily, whereas we as humans might try to hide those evil inclinations, what Jesus says in that parable, and what Jesus is saying here is that we can't hide it from God. God will sort it all out. Just as easily as one can see what's a weed and what's not once they grow. Just a gardener or a farmer can. Just as easily as a shepherd can. A shepherd could stand up on the top of a hill and look down in the valley and tell you how many sheep and goats were there without having to walk down there. And so we can't hide those things, and the inclinations will come out. If our inclination is more evil than good, it will come out, and vice versa. Now, there were Pharisees. We've talked about this briefly before, kind of as an aside. The Talmud lists seven different kinds of Pharisees, and one of those Pharisees is the ever-reckoning Pharisee. He wanted to keep up. He kept a running list of all the good deeds that he did and all the bad deeds that he did, because you didn't want to die with too many bad deeds. You were not based on all your deeds. You were based, your punishment or your reward were based on the majority of your deeds. So if you did, if 51% of the things you did in your life were good, then God would disregard all the bad and you'd be rewarded for the good. If 51% of them were evil deeds, God would forget you did all this, anything good at all, and you'd be punished for the evil deeds. And so they kept a running tally. And you didn't want to, you know, you didn't want to die with too many good ones because, well, shoot, I had an opportunity to be bad, and I didn't even do it. Yeah. But you also didn't want to die with too many of those evil opportunities. So you just kind of kept it going. And, hey, well, let's see, I've done five more in this year. I got a few I can waste next year. Yeah, that kind of thing. But the ever-reckoning Pharisee was doing that because they were being judged, and they understood that at some point out there, God would separate it out, and you couldn't hide it from God. Scapegoat, actually, for the people was a good thing. Wasn't so good for the goat. Because in that ceremony at Yom Kippur, two goats were separated out. Lots were cast on them. The lot that fell on the one for the Lord, he got to die quickly. They sacrificed him. The other one had the priest would take the goat or to the door of the tent of meeting and pronounce all the confessed sins of the people for the past year on it. And then that goat would be led into the wilderness and either tied to a tree so that evil could come that lived in the wilderness could come and get it because evil was drawn to evil. Or depending on where they were, sometimes they might shove it off a cliff. Yeah, I don't know of any recorded event, but I've often wondered, you're taking a chance if you take that goat out there in time with a rope in the wilderness and then you stay camped for a couple of more days. He might eat through the rope and come back. but you know, there was... So for the goat, it wasn't good. But for the people, the scapegoat carried away their sins. Of course, you had to confess them. And if you didn't confess them, you couldn't be forgiven for them. So there's this idea here that God still, regardless of what we may think and how we look at folks and situations, that we can't hide the good that is in there, we can't hide the bad that's in there from God. Mm-hmm. Yes, and the pure in heart in the Beatitudes, the pure in heart are those who, it's not just those who are morally correct. The pure in heart are those who work very hard at making sure that their thoughts are in line with what God would have take place. The pure-hearted, the heart was the seat of the intellect and where you made your inmost decisions. And so your intellect was used in such a way that you sought to find what God's will was and then make your decisions based on that rather than saying, okay, God, this is what I want to do. Now, you make your will the same as mine. And so the pure-hearted... hopefully, pure-heartedness would lead you to do good as a natural outcome of that. But the pure-hearted weren't just people that went around and did good deeds and gave millions to charity. While, on the other hand, the way they got it was they cheated at business. That kind of thing. Ananias and Sapphira would not have been among the pure-hearted. Yeah. Matthew chapter 6, Sermon on the Mount. Yeah. Do not be like the hypocritas. When you give your alms, give it in secret, so that the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. Because if you give it for the praise of men, he says that's the only thing you get is the praise of men. Don't sound the trumpet like the hypocritas. There are two ideas on that. One is, and there were actually people that when it come time to put the money in a collection box or to give alms to a charity or something, that have trumpets blown so that everybody can gather around and watch. The other one is there were at some of the collection boxes, there were brass horns that fed down like a funnel into it. And so the wealthy, you know, they didn't have paper money. So the wealthy people would gather around and they'd see all these wealthy guys walking in with all this money and all these coins, all these bags, and they'd see who made the loudest noise and the longest noise tossing their money in. Yeah, you could really be impressive if you know somebody came in, they tossed in, say, the equivalent of 100 quarters, and you come in with nothing but pennies and start throwing it in. Yeah. Yes. Throwing these big, and she just gave what she could.
Yeah.
It was more blessed. Why? Because she would have been among the pure-hearted. She would have given for the right reason, etc. You know, and so. The hypocritas, the hypocrites, the play actors.
I mean, how come that's still so real? Haven't we learned in 400 years that that's not what it's supposed to be about?
Yeah, we hadn't learned, actually, since the time of Jesus, as I mentioned this morning, it's 1986 years. But Gutenberg, because we are. But we study it and we spend time with it. And do you have favorite parts? Anybody? Do you have parts you try to avoid? I asked Rebecca Lound to. She's going to be one of the readers on Thursday night, and she said sure, as long as it doesn't have a whole bunch of hard names in it. Well, but that's how people trace their heritage and saw some sense of importance was the lineage there. But Susan, we're slow learners. We're quick to forget. I have often said for about 25 years now, I have said very often in classes and other places that Christianity will not be undone by even Satanism. If Christianity is going to be undone, it's going to be undone by the sin of forgetfulness. We get to a point where we forget what we're supposed to be doing. We get comfortable doing that. Go back to the book of Judges. The theological structure of the book of Judges. People are in covenant with God. The people sin. They break the covenant. Punishment. God allows a nation to come and overthrow them and generally rule cruelly. Then God raises up a judge, which is not like our typical judges, but a hero or heroine, H-E-R-O-I-N-E, very important to put the E on the end of that, like Deborah, to call them to repentance. And then once they come to the point of repentance, all of a sudden the dueling banjos start playing, and there's deliverance. God delivers them through the judge, and the text will say, and the land had rest for 20 years, or the land had rest for 80 years. What that means is, as long as that judge was still alive leading the people, and as long as the people continued to abide by the teachings of that judge based on their religious writings, the way they led them back in relationship with God, the land had rest. Things were good. Almost every time in the book of Judges, within two verses, a couple places where it's three, but within 2 to 3 verses, the text will say, and the people again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals and the Asherah. So they sin. Then they're punished. Then a judge comes. They repent. Then they're delivered. And the land had rest. And again the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And I think we get sometimes that whole thing. And Jesus warns against taking the easy way. Broad is the way that leads to destruction. And many find the way there. But narrow is the way. Narrow and hard is the way that leads to life, and too few. And few find their way. I say too few, but few find their way there. Jesus says, take the narrow way, take the hard way, not the easy way out. And a lot of times we get tired and we want to take the easy way out. And sometimes the easy way out gets exacerbated by the fact that, well, we've done it that way, or people have taught it that way, and people have thought it that way, and it's comfortable, and it doesn't require all this stuff, so we do it. And so we get immune. We get inoculated against true religion. And then we come back sometimes, and that's good, but then we get comfortable again, and we get more inoculations and that kind of thing. And Jesus is saying, yeah, God's going to sort it all out here. He's telling them in these parables, God is going to really sort it all out. But, he says, you got to grow. And how do you, you got to make sure that you don't let the weeds get so intertwined in your own life that you become pulled up like the weeds. One New Testament writer says, and I quote, "The question this parable raises is, granted that it tells us the world will always, until the end, be a corpus ad mixtum." That is, just a body of all kinds of stuff mixed together. "Should we also accept that the community of God will be that way as well, rather than just a holy club?" One clue that the answer is yes, that is, that even the community of God has that mixture, and we have to worry about whether we're, and at different points in time, we might have weedy offshoots. You ever grow, your husband used to grow rose bushes. Is he still growing? Okay. I'm down to one. I've had it for a long time, but I'm down to one. I'm planting other things now. And somebody gave an evening primrose last year, and it lasted for a while, and then it died off, and we just kind of didn't do anything. Those things spread. You know that? Evening primrose. I got an area now this big off of one plant that they're just going everywhere. But they move and produce like that. But the thing he's saying here is just like life in general, the world in general until the end, is going to have that mixture. So even the community of God gets that mixture. And sometimes we float in and out. And where I was going with the rose thing, I had a rose bush, nice cultivator, and I let it really go one year. And I mean, it went back. It must have originally been bred from a wild rose bush, because I had these funky looking leaves all on it. And the buds started looking real strange, and instead of getting larger like they had been, they were just little bitty and popping open. Okay. Okay, so it's a rootstock. Okay, so that's kind of like, and so they graft them on that woody stock. So it takes off in wild ways, kind of like woodstock. No. Okay. Well, so I learned something here. But you get those, and sometimes we are like that. We get that way, and we need to be pruned back or whatever. He says, even the church is that way. And he said, should we accept that the community of God will be that way as well, rather than a holy club? One clue that the answer is yes is that even among the 12, there turned out to be one bad guy whom Jesus chose, even though he had some premonition of what he would be like and would do. He would betray him. And another who swore his loyalty but ended up denying him three times. In other words, end of quote. Even the church is not immune to those kinds of things. And even we in the church at different points in our lives may turn out to be the wild sucker on the rootstock or whatever. And be drawn back in. And that's part of the whole dilemma. And to make sure that when it finally comes down to the end, not whether that's the end of the world or the end of our life, my end, that hopefully we have gotten to the point to where we are more like the wheat, more like the acceptable fish. Just learned the other day. Y'all know what tilapia is also called? With a biblical... All kinds of things. Y'all like tilapia? Tilapia is pretty good. Tilapia is pretty good if you do it right. I prefer a grouper and really red snapper. But tilapia is called St. Peter's fish. Didn't know that till a couple of weeks ago. It's called St. Peter's fish because tilapia were among the most common fish in the Sea of Galilee. Among the most common fish in the Sea of Galilee. So you've got one, in all of that you've got one who denies and one who betrays, and Jesus knew that, so the church itself is like that. Even Simon Peter, who led in so many different ways, at one point in time had weeds. Was not the desired fish, the tilapia. But I guess maybe he was a catfish. You know, Jews can't eat fish. Yeah, but Jews can't eat fish that do not have fins and scales. They got to have both fins and scales before they can be eaten. So what he's saying here is we need to be careful. This is from wish this was original with me, but it was from one of my professors from a long time ago. And I've told my wife, see, I don't need to throw away all those notebooks with notes from 40 years ago. Because I was looking through and ran across this, and he said, of these parables, Jesus is saying we are to gather, not judge, and let God sort the evil from the righteous. We are to gather. To gather for worship, gather for support, and not to judge, and let God sort the evil from the righteous. What about the parable of the mustard seed? Jesus tells that parable. We're a small church, right? There's some of those big ones out there too. But are we, as a small church, any less integral or less important? No. In fact, Jesus says that the kingdom of God is made up more of small groups that then flourish and grow together. And that's part of what the parable of the mustard seed is about. He put before them another parable, verse 31. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in the field. It is the smallest of all the seeds. Now, we know it's not. There are orchid seeds that are much smaller. But back then, it was one of the smallest seeds around. And the Sinopis nigra, which is the plant, the mustard plant that was common to Palestine, was among the smallest of the mustard plant seeds as well. But when it has grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. One ancient description of a mustard plant was that it was taller than a horse and his rider, so that the rider of a horse could seek shade under its branches. Now, some of them didn't get that big. They stayed bushy. But if they got the proper rain and proper fertilizer and proper sunlight, they went from a small, 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 itty-bitty seed into a large shrub or tree. And birds made their nests in it, and birds ate from it. Jesus here, I think, is trying to tell us as his disciples, to teach us that just because we are small, just because sometimes it may look like we're not the big flashy, that we might be seemingly ineffective by the world, with God, we can grow and have an influence that's far beyond even our own area. Goes along with the yeast and the leaven. The parable that suggests that the kingdom may seem small, but works in undetectable ways, sometimes even quiet ways, to advance the kingdom in greater ways. I know it's going to surprise you, but Jimmy Buffett's song came to mind when I read that, you know, quietly making noise. But we seem to be sometimes ineffective by the world standards. But the world standards are not the standards. You know, one of the things that happened in the church a long time ago that has not necessarily been good for the church as a whole, we adopted the corporate model. Oh, they do. It is. And, yeah. Right. Yeah. But the church adopted the corporate model of and corporate expansion and those kinds of things and began judging by those standards as opposed to the standards. The church is at its best when the church is filled with plotters. PLODDERS, right? We plot along, but we plot along steadily and slowly. Right. No. You know, Jesus said...
But in America,
that's hard for us to come to grips with. Yeah. Yeah, we repeat it because, you know, we want the success. The success model that we have is the success model of corporate business. And... It can be, and I think I wrote down a page number here. Yes, page 51 of your book. Tom Long, in talking about this in the middle of the page, when he's talking about Jesus said the woman took yeast and hid it. The hiding of the yeast in the dough suggests the kingdom of heaven operates in quiet and undetected ways, secretly but surely subverting the kingdoms of this world. And the quote in the next sentence, since yeast was viewed negatively, Jesus seems to have been saying that the kingdom is, and this quote, Tom Long is responsible for this, quote, the kingdom is, quote, a hidden force working silently to corrupt the world. That is, to corrupt the corruption. Do what? Well, no, to corrupt the corruption. The world corrupts us, and what the church is to do in dealing with the world is not necessarily to get out there and stand and shake our fists in their face, but work quietly. Work quietly, becoming friends, befriending, and then talking, and then helping the world to change. The corruption that is in the world, we then corrupt. It's a counter-corruption. Leading by example, but it's changing that which is corrupt into something that is good. So we corrupt the corruption of the world. Now, I know that sounds negative, but at the same time, it's not that we go in and we're trying to harmfully change it. We're trying to corrupt it in a positive way, that is, change it. And that's what he means by corrupt the corruption. To take that which is in here and to change it. Adoniram Judson. Y'all know who Adoniram Judson was? Long time ago. Yes, he was a long time ago, and you knew it a long time ago, right? He was a missionary to Burma. No, he wasn't responsible for the Burma shave signs. But no, he was a missionary to Burma. He was in Burma for 20 years, and nothing really happened. For 20 years, he lived among the Burmese people, trying to preach and get them to accept the gospel. The tribes in Burma. A chieftain, after 20 years, one of the chieftains got tired of hearing all these gospel messages and not seeing a whole lot of change in other people. You know, because he thought, well, this man is coming, he's giving us this message and it ought to change. But people remained corrupt and all those kinds of things, and it didn't seem to change. And so he decided, he told him to stop preaching, and Adoniram Judson wouldn't, so he decided he was going to stop him. He was going to burn him at the stake. And so he had him tied to a stake, had the wood, that's S-T-A-K-E, had the wood placed around him and prepared, kindling all there, and lit a torch. And just before actually lighting the wood, he looked at Adoniram Judson in the face and said, "So what do you think of your God now?" Judson, the story is from a witness that was there. Judson looked him straight in the eye and said, "The future is just as bright as all the promises of God." At which point the chief took a step back. Fortunately, he didn't drop the torch. Thought for a moment, put the torch out, released Adoniram Judson, and said, "We will talk more about your God." And eventually, that chief became a believer in Jesus and had an influence on other members of his tribe as well as other tribes. 20 years, he was corrupting the corruption. He was working like yeast or leaven in the dough. Just a little bit. I made a mistake one time when I was going to fix, I forget what it was, it's years and years ago, and I put a little bit too much of that stuff in. And by the time I went to cook, I can't remember if it was cake or if it was loaves of bread, I thought somebody had pumped helium in that thing. So, no matter how small or ineffective we may think we are, whether as individuals or as a church, Jesus is saying here that we have more influence. If we will do so, we have more influence than the world. And that we are about seeking to change the world in small ways. Yeah. The world gets changed for the gospel one person at a time, does it not? And that in the end, it will be God who will sort out that which is good from that which is not. It's not up to us to make that decision for God. It's up to us, that decision on behalf of God, it's up to us to make the decision for God to follow, even in the small ways, to be the leaven, to be the mustard seed, to be the good that grows among the weeds. Always remembering that we too are being judged by God, even as we do. And that our motives should always be among the pure in heart. Wish that was easy to do. It's not. But then again, if it was, we'd have too easy a road. And Jesus surely didn't take the easy way out. Anything else? I know we've run over 6 minutes. Go figure. Okay. Of course, we won't be here next Sunday night, but we will continue the following. And even though it may seem a little anticlimactic because it's going to deal with the passion, we will deal with the passion that Sunday after Easter in here, the next chapter in the book. Thank you. God bless you, and go in peace.